This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
Lucy Treloar was born in Malaysia and educated in England, Sweden, and Melbourne. Her debut novel, Salt Creek, won the Dobie Literary Award, among others, and was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Literary Award and the UK's Walter Scott Prize. Wolf Island, Treloar's second novel, won the Barbara Jeffress Award and was shortlisted for the Prime Minister's and New South Wales Literary Awards. She is a previous winner of the Commonwealth Short Story Prize. Lucy's essays and short fiction have appeared in publications including The Saturday Paper, Meanjin, The Age, Overland, Best Australian Stories and Foundational Fictions in South Australian History. A graduate of the University of Melbourne and RMIT, Lucy lives in Inner Melbourne with her family. We have spoken to Lucy before on the First Time Podcast for the Apollo Bay Word Fest's Warm Winter Words in 2020. Treloar's third novel is Days of Innocence and Wonder, published by Pan Macmillan in October 2023. Lucy Treloar, what a joy to welcome you to the First Time Podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's just lovely being here.
Lucy, I want to go back before we come to the present and ask you about your first writing experiences, or perhaps the first time you ever saw your words in print. Can you remember when you thought of yourself first as a storyteller or a writer?
I vividly remember the moment when I saw something, and I think I was about seven, and I thought, I must capture that. Like, I really, in a very out-of-body way, thought, I have to write this moment. It's so extraordinary. And it was just a quality of light on our street. And it was very secret, this experience. I went inside and I wrote it down in a little notepad, a poem, and I kind of worked at it. And then I read it over and I just was crushed. I was absolutely appalled by it. And I just thought, oh, God, and kind of ashamed at my failure, I think, to capture it. And I just thought, oh, this writing thing, it's tricky.
That's so interesting. There's a couple of things there, Lucy. One of them is because I know the last time we spoke, we talked about the fact that you as a writer are often drawn to water. But this time in reading your new book, I was really struck by how often you write about the quality of light. So that's extraordinary that that has always been something for you.
Yeah.
But so the shame, as you describe it, by seeing the gap between what you wanted to capture and what you could capture, did you keep on working at it? Was it something that then you had the bug, or did you put that aside for a while then?
No, I put it away for years, many years. And I think, yeah, and I used to try writing diaries. I would get a diary and I would write, you know, three lines saying I went and picked the guinea pig grass and just really inspirational stuff like that. And then I'd put it away. And, yeah, much, much later, I did a little bit of rock music journalism. That was kind of interesting. That was probably my first published work, I think. In my 20s, I tried a novel and I just thought, oh, yes, that seems like a lot of work. The thing that really struck me was the amount of work it took to make something okay and realising that that was the case for everyone. It took me years to work that out. That it was a kind of drawn-out process, it was a rigorous thing. It was actual work. It wasn't just sitting there thinking, yes, I have I'm special, I can write. Like, I don't think that happens to anyone. We all kind of struggle away with it and despair and so on.
So the space between this failed novel, first attempt in your 20s, and you coming to publish your first novel, Salt Creek, what happened in those intervening years in your writing life, and how did you come to Salt Creek?
I had I have children, and somehow I have never been able to write very well around small children. But I did write a couple of children's picture books in the early 2000s, just through RMIT. I managed to slog my way through those and have them published. And then we moved to Cambodia for several years, and I really loved it. But I didn't do a huge amount of writing, except that towards the end, I was thinking, all right, we're heading home. I really want to sort of feel like I've got something out of this. And I used to sit at this cafe practicing writing in a kind of plain, unembellished way, trying to capture scenes, things out of the window. I was writing at the time for a tourism magazine, and I would try and pare my language back a bit. I'm not really known for pared back language, but anyway, this is what I was aiming for, just trying to capture things. And when we came back home, I was severely depressed because I just loved living in Cambodia, and it was just tough coming back to Melbourne. You know, I love Melbourne, but it was tough coming back to it at that time. And went to RMIT, and I just thought, you know what? I said that I was doing editing. That's what I had officially enrolled for. But I'm just going to try that novel writing subject. And that's what I did. And I just, oh, no, I was really gripped by it and kind of appalled by it. But this kind of stubbornness kicked in. And I think stubbornness is such an important quality for writers to acquire, that idea that you don't give up just because something's not working, a piece of writing's not working, you get rejected, all of those things. And it was that accumulation of some kind of experience and that feeling of being in a cohort of people who were going through the same stuff. It was a kind of life-changing experience for me, and in a way, just because of that depression I'd had, I think I felt like it saved me. It really genuinely saved me from a kind of bitterness that might have set in if I hadn't really, really worked at it.
Mm. I love that we have such similarities in some ways, Lucy, because I too went to RMIT. Mm. And thinking or telling myself and others that I was going to do editing and, you know, whereas secretly wanting to do the novel. Mm. Tell us about the process then and the trajectory through RMIT. Were you submitting short stories at the same time as working on your novel? What was happening at that period in your writing?
I approached it in this incredibly, I'm not an organised person. I'm sort of organised in a writing sense, but I'm a little bit haphazard in the way I approach a lot of things. I start things and put them down. But I really went at writing in a very kind of coherent, strategic way. Kind of, I did a lot of reading about it. I looked into approaches, and I realised pretty quickly that for me doing the kind of writing I did, getting some short story publications would be important. And even though I don't think of myself as a short story writer, and I've only written like 5 short stories in my life, I set out to write a good short story. And I would map out really great short stories to see how they organize time frames. And then I would try and replicate that kind of structure in my own writing. I can remember lining up scenes on the floor in these kind of grid work patterns, you know, the different time frames. Anyway, it was probably the most important writing exercise I ever set myself. So I did those, got some publications with the short stories, and then I thought, all right, now I have to enter those other competitions, you know, the writing manuscript, the unpublished manuscript competitions. And so I started doing that, and I didn't get anywhere with the Vic Writers one, but I won there was a very short-lived writing prize called the Writing Australia Unpublished Manuscript Award. Hannah Kemp won it the first year and got a gazillion dollar advance. And I won it the second year. That was the only 2 years. And publishers looked at the manuscript and said, yeah, we've tried those expat novels and they don't sell. And passed, But Alex Craig, who was then at Pan Macmillan, said, I like the book, we can't sell it, what else have you got? And I had 5,000 words of Salt Creek, and she said, great, finish that by the end of the year, you've got a contract.
Wow.
So I had my contract, I had my advance, and I don't even know how I did it. I'm a really slow writer, but I wrote Salt Creek in a year, bam, like that. That was all I did.
That's extraordinary. Having that contract and invitation to submit to Pan Mac, do you see that now as being a really significant part of how that got written, how you got Salt Creek written?
I do. But I think it was also partly that I had, it was wonderful having a publisher's confidence. Like they had given me the contract and said, now go and write the book. I guess that first book I wrote was important because it demonstrated that I could write a novel. So that kind of confidence was great. I think it was just, I don't even know how I did it. I just set myself to write 1,000 words a day. I broke my back that year. And I remember lying in hospital with this mask on my, you know, this great big head thing, and they said, oh, 2 vertebrae, that's not very good. And I'm thinking, do you know how many days I've lost? That's 5,000 words I've got to catch up now. And I just ploughed on somehow.
At that stage then, you went into that contract for Salt Creek without an agent.
I did have an agent, yeah.
Okay, fantastic. So how did you go about doing that? Was that off the Writing Australia Prize?
So that was part of, no, that was, yes, it was actually. So I had those publications, won that prize and started contacting agents. I had been contacting agents before and had been rudely rebuffed sometimes. But, you know, I just think you pick yourself up and you keep moving on. Yeah, so I got an agent and she shopped the manuscript around, the one that won the manuscript award, and no one picked it up, but she arranged the deal for Salt Creek, and I proceeded from there.
That first manuscript, will it forever stay in the drawer?
I had a look at it. I think it's quite good. They liked it at Pan Macmillan. They just said, yeah, we cannot sell more than 1,000 copies of this kind of book. Australia's just too parochial. They said there's just not an audience for this kind of thing. Lovely work, though. What else? So I just kind of weathered the humiliation, I think, of people saying, oh, how great, you won the prize, when's the book coming out? No, no one wants it. And thinking, you know, humiliation is not the end of the story. It's just part of the entire picture.
It is. It's a hard part of the entire picture.
Bad bit. Yeah. It's terrible.
Lucy, I want to ask about, so Salt Creek very firmly in the historical fiction realms did very well in that space. Your second novel, Wolf Island, was in the speculative fiction realm, although it wasn't marketed necessarily as such, but it was in that realm. Days of Innocence and Wonder, your third novel, is a contemporary, could almost be described as a literary crime, although it kind of branches out further than that. How have you felt about this idea of changing lanes, or how has your publisher felt? Because I know that certainly from my experience, there was an expectation, you do your first historical fiction, it goes very well, and then can you please just hand over your next historical fiction?
So you didn't do that, did you?
I didn't do that, yes.
So, and why did you not?
That's because I'm stubborn.
Yeah, same.
and so is that, but did you feel that pressure? Did you have those conversations?
No, but I remember them in 2016, so that's the year after Salt Creek came out, actually the night of the Miles Franklin Award night, I was chatting to my publisher, and she said, oh, you know, we want to make an offer on your next book. And I said, oh, great. Only it's not going to be historical. And they kind of went, you know, oh, okay. And it's not going to be set in Australia. And they kind of blanched again. And they said, oh, well, that's all right. And so I had it, you know, they were prepared for that. They did say why, and I said, oh, I just think that's what I'm going to be writing about. That's what I'm interested in. So they just And a lovely thing about Pam McMillan is that they just encourage you to do, they're interested in supporting the writer and their work and making a space for that to be possible. And I have appreciated that so much. I was fortunate, but I'm sure it would have been a lot easier in a lot of ways if it had just been historical, if I'd written a sequel to Salt Creek and I could see four different sequels I could do. But I just thought, I've done that world. That's it. I'm finished.
How have you found reader responses to moving with you through those first two novels? I know that you're not really in the reader response world because your book is only just out. But how did you find readers moving from Salt Creek to Wolf Island with you?
Well, there is this kind of split, I guess, between people who really love love historical fiction and people who love things that are a little bit more speculative. At least that's what I found. And there are people who do straddle those two things. They will kind of travel with you with your writing or your approach to material. But I often come across, I know people say don't read your Goodreads reviews, but I am fascinated by them. And I very rarely get upset by anything, even a really awful review. I just think, oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. Fascinating. Well, it's good to know what the market's perceiving. And there's a kind of divide often, people saying, oh, I loved Salt Creek. I don't know what she was doing getting into this, or oh, I didn't really like Salt Creek, but this is great. You just take those things. Yeah, you can't please everyone. But I think it's interesting to see what people are reading, you know, how they approach it.
As you've come through your career, do you find yourself thinking about readership at particular points in the novel writing process? Is it something you try to hold at bay until a certain draft, or are you aware of the reader at all times when you're writing?
I think we have that that feeling of kind of going in and out of that. If I'm writing a part of a book, for instance, there are these sections in Days of Innocence and Wonder that are a little bit about COVID lockdown and Till walking through the lanes of Brunswick, these kind of very narrow back street lanes, and thinking, oh gosh, are people going to go with me with this? Well, I'll just keep going with it now, and I just would kind of push it away because it wasn't like a darling, but I had this great resistance to getting rid of it, and I can see why it's important in a kind of psychological framing of this psychological claustrophobia that she feels. So I kept it in, but I think it was trimmed back. We trimmed it back a little bit just to make it a little bit less claustrophobic for the reader, I guess, as well. So there is that point where you do consider the reader, but it is sort of a tussle, I guess, isn't it? What is important? It's really important, but not as a darling. That you really want to hang on to.
I was listening back to a conversation that we had in 2020 for the Apollo Bay Words Fest. And at that point we were talking about Wolf Island, and you were thinking about cities not being safe anymore. We were in lockdown at the time, and you were also wondering about the idea of post-COVID, how we might run away from cities and begin to live in countries, towns, or even outside of country towns. It's extraordinary. It was really interesting to hear you talk about, because you were talking about it in relation to Kitty Hawk, the character in Wolf Island. But then listening to that and having seen the Till's journey in Days of Innocence and Wonder was really interesting. So I want to just move to Days of Innocence and Wonder now. It's the story of Till. It shifts between her childhood in 2004 when her friend is abducted from the secret play area at Kinder, and then 2021 and 2022 as Till flees Melbourne and kind of this sense of her ongoing trauma and makes a new home for herself in what is a fictional town. Where are we? Is that how I say it?
Wirrawee
in rural South Australia, which is on Ngadjeri lands. When did you realise, considering there's this little seed in that conversation we had in 2020, when did you realise you were writing Till's story? When did the book begin for you?
I would have seen probably in 2020, I think. Yeah, it would have been 2020. I'm a great procrastinator, but I have come to see it as a particular skill of its own. But I'm very interested in these sort of ghost towns, these ruined buildings in South Australia. In fact, I'm interested in ruins generally and have a collection of books about ghost towns in various places. I love them. And saw a picture of a railway station in a kind of remote part of South Australia. It was just abandoned. And I thought, I think I might write a novel about that. And it was something similar happened with Wolf Island. And so then the next part is, who is living in this railway station? What kind of person would leave the comfort of Melbourne for something like that? And why would they do that? What kind of psychological event would drive a person to abandon their life? And then everything proceeds as a kind of almost like a series of questions. A character pops into my head, you know, what might be the trauma that she's escaping? I had this, I remember this thing that happened when my kids were at kinder, that there was a child who escaped from kindergarten once. And there was this, no one really knew how it had happened. But it was kind of terrifying for the parents who knew about it and was kind of clamped down. And it always stuck with me, this, you know, what if that child had not been returned? I think it's a kind of great fear of parents. But I also had this thing that had happened in my childhood, that I had lost my dearest, dearest friend. Not, she didn't die, but she moved overseas. And I have never forgotten the stricken grief that children feel over those kinds of losses. And I think we kind of forget those things. I was tapping into that a little bit as well. So it's those kind of fragmentary things. Mm. Not that I was writing about my life, but I was tapping into some of my experience to write about Till's life. I'm nothing like Till.
I love that idea of a series of kind of images and questions, or moments and questions, for anyone who follows your photography sometimes on social media. Those images of ruins and abandoned places are really key. You can kind of, now I've traced back and seen, this is part of what Lucy was doing there. Mm. So during that research phase, or that thinking, or the establishing of questions, how are you drawing together your research and images? Do you note everything down? Do you just let it waft around in the brain? Do you do everything, or you're thinking first and then start writing? What does that research process look like for you?
Probably a little bit chaotic. It is just this great big kind of sea of stuff. But the travel part of it, visiting a location, because place is incredibly important to me in writing. I think for me, just to inhabit the writing, if I can feel that place that I'm writing about, makes a huge difference. So visiting those places is really important, and keeping a record, a photographic record of them. Not that I'm going to write about it in a kind of literal way, but as a reminder, that place, I remember how I felt in that place. So they're kind of jumping off points. But I always think of this thing that Rebecca Solnit says, that you have to go and get lost to find the thing that you don't know you're looking for. And that's what I think when I'm driving. I think, why am I back in this place? And after I go back four or five times, I think, right, I get it now. This is the place I'm writing about. And I start taking little notes, little fragmentary. I'm thinking in images then. I have these index cards or tiny little notebooks I take around with me. Or with this book, I had my phone, because I listen to things in the Lane podcast, your podcast, and I'm taking these little notes on my note function. And so I've got these kind of streams of fragmentary phrases or ideas or suggestions for plots, those sorts of things. And then I go back to my computer and just try and write it out and see how it all fits together.
Do you go back to those, Lucy? It's always interesting to me, because I think that sometimes we take those notes, like the waking up in the middle of the night to write down something that's unintelligible in the morning, partly just to get them out of the brain, and the process of writing them down is all that needs to be done, and we don't go back. But do you go back to notes when you're stuck or when you're looking for a way forward?
I do. Yeah, you know that there's sometimes that feeling at the start of the day, you just think, oh, there is nothing in my head. I don't know what's going on in this book. What's she doing? Who are these people? All of that stuff. But that process of walking and those little ideas that come into my head, when I look back at them on the phone, I think, ah, that's right. That's right. They're often about how am I going to cut into a scene? How am I going to drop into it? It's that kind of getting over that little hurdle of inhabiting that bit of world. And those notes, yeah, they're often really important. And sometimes they're bizarre. And I look back and I think, what? What were you even thinking? That obviously wasn't going to work. That character's disappeared. There's a lot of that sort of stuff. But in the middle of it, there are these little nuggets and things develop from those. Yeah.
I went back to some early interviews that you did after Salt Creek, and one of the things I think is really interesting is that you commented on this idea of you know, not being much interested in plot. And yet in this book, in Days of Innocence and Wonder, and especially in the crime genre, which this doesn't necessarily fit into, but the historical crime does certainly play a role throughout the story. Mm. Was that a new challenge for you to deal with in terms of the writing of this book, in how you were going to follow that crime and its repercussions throughout Till's life?
Yeah, I suppose when I say that I'm not much interested in plot, I mean that I don't know how to follow a plot line as a way of approaching writing a book. Mm. So what I'm looking at, I think, is really what is going on with this character. What might she see? And while I'm writing along, and I'm sure this is where the unconscious writing process comes in, there will be a little something that appears and I think, aha, that creepy man walking down the pathway, he's going in the book. Mm. And there's this scene where Till is walking in a park and she sees this man walking in a kind of odd way, and he holds his hand in an odd way. And I saw this very strange man in the park one day, and he held his finger in this very weird way that I found incredibly troubling. And this was during lockdowns. And I just thought, oh, what? And also, you know, it just felt this terrible shiver of revulsion. Not anyway, shiver of revulsion. And I thought, I must write that down immediately. I'm going to use that. And I didn't know where, but I just thought there will be a place for it. So I think it's keeping that unconscious mind going. I think Anne Lamott talks about there's a child in a coal mine and they're handing up pieces of paper into the light. And I just think, thank you, child, coal mine person, handing up those little slivers of scenery, scenes. Yeah.
Inside. I love that. Lucy, you spoke a little before about the writing of lockdowns. And I know, you know, from experience, I also wrote about lockdowns, and that there was this sense that publishers were somewhat wary of COVID books.
I was so glad you did.
Yeah. And also, as you spoke about that idea of how do I take a reader into this without overwhelming them, you know, with allowing them to move forward? You've said you were taking notes at that time. Were you conscious that you were going to write the lockdowns into Till's story, or did that come a little bit later after we'd kind of moved out of being in them?
Mm. I think I contemplated it pretty early. I could see the possibilities of it. And one of the things that I love about novels is that in some ways, even though they're fictional, they serve a documentary function as well. And none of us enjoyed lockdown, but I did find it incredibly fascinating, and the ways that we all behaved was fascinating. And I remember watching people in the park and thinking, oh, you would never normally be doing this in the park. You would never normally be saying these things. It's because it was a different space, and people forgot their kind of public facades somehow and became a truer version of themselves. So I really wanted to include something like that for that reason. Yeah, but I think it was the possibilities that it offered in a sort of psychological way for the creation of this character, Till, that it reflected some of her own emotional claustrophobia, this feeling of a psychological compression she experienced in the aftermath of the loss of her friend, that that's the world that she lives in, and she sees other people now feeling that same kind of psychological compression. So I was pretty interested in it. But I know that there were conversations about it, like how much are we going to put in? How much can the reader bear, I suppose? And you don't really know that. Just hope that you can take readers along. But I always think, you know, if you don't like a bit, skip it.
Skip it.
I'm always skipping bits in books. I think, oh, this is a bit boring. I'm just going to move past that.
That's my approach too. Is this true? Now I can't remember if I read this about you or heard you speak it. Are you one of those strange people, Lucy, who cuts to the end of a book and reads the end?
Yes. Always. Why not?
This blows my mind. Okay, tell me. And then do you decide whether or not you're going to read through the whole book on that assessment of the end of the book, start of the book, end of the book?
This is always my approach to reading. I read the first page, maybe two pages. I read the last page and maybe the last two pages. Then I read a section in the middle and I think, oh, interesting. I was not expecting that. Let me see what goes on in all of the other parts of the book. I've done it since I was very small.
I was going to say, when did this begin? Was there someone in your family who also read like this? What this blows my mind. I don't like
suspense. I'm not good with suspense. I don't like being scared. I don't like being tense. It's very hard for me to write tension. And sometimes publishers say to me, I think you might have to go here. And I just sit there thinking, I'm just going to have to get so upset. And I avoid it like anything. So I find it very soothing reading the end.
Wow. It blows my mind. It's so impressive to me. It blows my mind.
Beginning to end?
Oh, yeah. Beginning to end, but also I'm so scared of accidentally reading the last page and thus breaking the tension that because I like acknowledgements so much, if I'm reading the acknowledgements, I like purposefully cover with my hand the other side so I don't accidentally see the last line and thus spoil the reading experience.
The exact opposite.
Exact opposite. So interesting that someone should do a PhD on this. Okay, Lucy, I want to ask you about your approach in this book, in Days of Innocence and Wonder, to writing First Nations characters, especially the wonderful, and I'm going to try the pronunciation because you've written how to do it, Dundra, thank you, specifically. And the research and the work that's involved in this as a non-Indigenous writer. And I ask you this especially as we have talked about this before, not in a public forum after you wrote Salt Creek. And I'm particularly interested if there's things that you learnt from that first process that helped you navigate or meant that you did things differently this time in Days of Innocence and Wonder.
Yeah, this was radically different, absolutely radically different. And I think Salt Creek was really difficult from that point of view, and I had this huge change of direction in how I wrote that. I was going to write much more about the Narrangeri people and some of their mythology. I can't even believe I was contemplating it now, but times were a little bit different then. And I couldn't get great cooperation, kind of much assistance because of the kind of requests being made from the Narrangeri. I totally get it from their point of view. With this book, I had a huge amount of trouble finding a Narrangeri person to talk to. It took me a couple of years, and it was only a kind of chance recommendation for an organisation that helped me. And the kind of terrible fragmentation of Narrangeri people and culture across that country is part of what made that so difficult. But I did manage to locate someone, and she was absolutely fantastic, and we got on really well. And I just went and saw her several times in South Australia and just talked. And I kind of would take these frantic notes of everything she said and send them back to her and send the scenes to her to see if they were okay, talk them through. So all of the scenes had her approval, and it was just an incredibly rich, respectful, warm, professional, wonderful kind of cooperative way of creating a character. And it worked out really well. So she now wants to work on another project with me. And I just think, I just feel incredibly lucky to have had that experience. And I'm so glad I persevered. I would have had to change that character completely. And I could just feel that as a kind of terrible hole in the book. Evelyn Errolun says this great thing about writing these things. She says, I have this written down. One of the things she really is looking at is the pernicious erasure in Australian literature of Aboriginal presence and possession of our sovereign ancestral countries. And I desperately wanted to depict that in the ruined but beautiful landscape that is the mid-north of South Australia. I wanted to show that ongoing connection. Kind of lift up the hood of the facade, which in a way reflects that thing that I'm doing with Till. You know, she looks like a competent young woman, but there is just a great big mess underneath the kind of surface of her. So I think there's a huge amount that can be done with those things, and I was really interested in exploring that.
That's great. Thank you, Lucy. And I think it's really helpful to see a writer who has pushed through what is difficult, found the right people to speak to, done the work.
But it is so hard, and I often get emails from people saying, how did you find people? And I just, it's persistence, just keeping on ringing emails. There are various organisations, but I know it is really hard to find someone who's willing to work.
Mm. Lucy, what does your writing week look like? You talked before about that, you know, year when you wrote Salt Creek and you're doing 1,000 words a day. What does it look like now? Do you have a writing place at home or away from home? Do you still have a daily word count, a special teacup? What does your writing just look like?
Oh, well, you can see my bookshelves behind me here. I have a study here. Back in the day, I used to have an office at the meat market, which I absolutely loved. That's where I wrote Salt Creek. It was wonderful. And before that, I had an office at Glenfern, also great. The meat market worked until they decided they would give us all free internet. And I just you've ruined it now. It's a waste of money. There's no point in being here with the internet. I've got an office at home. So I work here. I'm a morning writer. Even though I sit at a computer for quite a while in the afternoon, I just think 50 words, well done, in the afternoon. But I can churn out quite a bit in the morning, but it's hard. And then I have another burst in the evening if I'm writing really well. But I must say that I have never really recaptured that incredible discipline that I had the year I was writing Salt Creek. And now I think I have worked out that I can sometimes just, if I'm passing by, go in and look at something that's open on the computer and have this little spark of something and think, that's what I could do with that. And then I frantically write, and then I might write 200 words, and then I don't know, take the dogs for a walk or whatever. So it feels a little bit more fragmented now than it used to. But I think we all just somehow do it if we have to, don't we? We find that little spot of time. And when you look back, I don't know, childbirth or something like that, I think, I don't really remember it, but I have a book. Yeah.
You do indeed. I really enjoy what I think is your very pragmatic approach to navigating book promotion. I liked seeing you say recently on Facebook, you know, I'm getting back on Facebook because I know that some of my reading community is here and I have a new book out. And it feels to me like you are kind of acknowledging the work to be done and respecting the ways in which it needs to be done in this current landscape, even if you don't love it. What is your approach to book promotion, to events, to social media? And has that changed over time, Lucy?
The importance of social media has changed a huge amount just in the last 10 years, I think, and it matters so much more for writers. And looking back at how it was even 4 years ago when Wolf Island came out, I think, whoa, things have really moved on since then. There are so many more social media platforms. I'm on six different things at the moment, and it is way too many. And I see these comments, and I have really valued genuinely, not in a commercial sense, the interactions with people on social media. I love those connections. But when there's six of them, I think, where were you? Where were you, lovely person who said that thing that I wanted to reply to, but I just didn't have that moment? It's chaotic. And I'm just going to have to pair them back somehow. Publishers are in that kind of state of flux as well, I think. So what is Threads? What is Blue Sky? Do we have to sink time into them? Are there writers there? There's a whole lot of flux in it. But I do think it's important. I think I love Twitter, but I'm a kind of political person on Twitter. I just kind of, talk about politics mostly. Instagram, gardening and books. If I turn it too much into one thing that feels a little bit not like me, I avoid it. So I think managing it in a way that suits you, your personality, makes a huge difference. You're inhabiting it in a true way then. And like all your socials, you convey that amazing kind of warmth and generosity of spirit and enthusiasm. And that is so you. It's a beautiful thing. I probably couldn't do that. So I look at that and I think, admiration, Kate, you are wonderful. I can do 20% of that.
You can also do very beautiful floral arrangements that I cannot do, and I always look forward to seeing them, Lucy.
That does a lot for say.
I also wanted to ask, and I had this in there, and then you said about reading Goodreads reviews. I went back to another old interview. You said, there's always another thing to hope for or to feel a sense of failure at not having achieved. And I was thinking about this in the sense of that you were commenting on critical response.
Yeah.
And the fact that you potentially do use reviews or critical or reader responses as having a place in your writing practice. So is that what you would say, or just you're interested in them?
I wouldn't say I'm interested in a kind of as a business person. I mean, that's the kind of business side of me. I think, oh, interesting. I just like to know what readers think, but I often just think, oh, well, you know, good on you. We're all individuals, but you're wrong. I think I don't take them especially personally, but I'm curious. I'm very curious. I wouldn't change things because of a review. I do remember this review I read of Salt Creek once, and it said it was filled with anachronisms. And I just thought, buddy, it was an historical fiction. Like, what do you expect? I can't help being curious about them. But I wouldn't change my writing because of them. There are a few critical responses that I would take notice of, I think. But I feel like most of the criticism I would hear of a kind of true sort, I would probably think myself. I just think, I know. It did start slowly, didn't it? Sorry about that. I'm doing my best.
It's a very healthy approach, Lucy. I love that. You have won literary awards. I know you've been successful in arts funding in the past. I think, although I always get this wrong, that you're now considered a mid-career author with three novels, although I'm not really sure when we get to be established. Yeah,
but I had this very conversation. I was out with a friend last night for dinner, and I said, I think I might be mid-career. I'm the mid-list person. She said, no, we were just talking about this.
Yeah, so I'm not sure. We'll have to seek a definition from the ASA. Yeah. ASA. You teach writing, you endorse books. So I'm wondering, in your opinion, what are the key elements to this idea of being a good industry citizen, which we talk about on the podcast a lot? What do you see your kind of entire lit world career encompassing?
Well, it's a many faceted thing, isn't it, being in the writing world? And when you start out, you're just writing, basically. I did a lot of creative writing teaching early on, a lot. It was basically how I funded my writing. But I did find in the end, as soon as I started writing more seriously, that I had to reduce that because I had so many other manuscripts in my head, so many other ideas. I cut right back on it. But I have mentored people, and I unofficially mentor people still. People I've taught before will get in touch and saying, I don't know what to do, and, you know, I'll suggest ways forward. write letters of recommendation, endorsements. I think all of those things make such a difference to new writers, that feeling that you're not on your own in a kind of sort of strange, unfathomable world. It's just a bunch of swirling currents before you really get the sense of what your trajectory is. And any sign of a person who's going to hold out a little hand and say, it's all right, we've all been there. Those sorts of things I think are really important. I don't know. I just, with the teaching, I'm not quite sure if I can go back to it much. I just have demonstrated it so many times to myself. If I'm writing and start teaching, I stop writing. So then I have to contain it in these very, very small pockets.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, something has to give. That? Yes, I think that the energy output when you look at it and you think, okay, if I bring just some of that back into my writing, what might that look like? Yeah. But I recall so vividly, Lucy, you launched my very first book, you did an endorsement for it, and you had a long conversation when I was deep in despair about certain aspects of my book before it was edited. But I think that those things, and you know, I think that as a model going forward, I've always remembered that and absolutely felt less alone for it. So thank you.
Oh, great pleasure.
Lucy, before I let you go, you have taught lots. You are officially mid-career, let's call it that. What's a piece of advice that that you perhaps share a lot or you think is the most valuable to pass on to our first-time podcast listeners about the writing world or practice?
Oh, well, I would say we all work out a way to write. Like I need to set myself words a day, just because I won't do any if I don't do that. But that's not for everyone, so I don't tell people those things. But I would say that it is worth, alongside your nurturing your creative self, it's worth being just a tiny little bit strategic and hard-headed and setting yourself these particular goals, like what do I need? How am I going to appeal to an agent? How am I going to make myself appeal to a publisher? Right. A novel is a big ask. I need to tell them that they need to read the novel. What else have I done? It's easier to get a short story published somewhere, to enter those competitions, to get somewhere with those things, and then to use that as a jumping off point for your next stage. It's a very kind of incremental thing, I think, often. I know some people get picked off the slush pile, which is unbelievable and incredible. Congratulations. But another way for people to get into it is to just take that incremental building approach. Write what you like. Write what you love reading. Start sending things out. Enter the competition. Spaghetti at a wall. I think all of those things just get a little bit easier. And build a community of writers around you that you can go and have a nice bottle of champagne with on a bad day or a good day, you know, the same treatment applies. That's what I recommend.
I love that. Spaghetti at the wall. Very good. Lucy, to finish, can you please recommend a debut novel anytime, any place?
Yeah, debut novels. I think it is very hard to go past Marilyn Robinson's Housekeeping. It is a wonderful, extraordinary, groundbreaking book that probably opened up for me all of the possibilities of the exploration of a psychological landscape, which I love to explore in reading and writing. It's just an extraordinary book, very slim, absolutely hypnotically beautiful and astounding. Yeah. And she wrote it out of a kind of psychologically compressed state herself in France. She was kind of stuck there, not speaking French, two small children, and she just started writing it.
I didn't know the story of how she wrote it.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Wow, such a good recommendation. Thank you. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.